Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for joining me today to celebrate our six-month anniversary show. We got a live audience. Yes. Thank you for listening, engaging with us, and a special thank you for the folks who are here live today at the Green Space at WNYC. You can watch this live stream, by the way, at WNYC.org, and as our audience will find out, a live radio show is kind of like getting on the 2 or 3 at 42nd Street. You're on till 72nd. No getting off. Coming up on the show today, we have the two creators of the Broadway musical Come From Away, and later, Carla Lally Music. She's the food director at Bon Appetit. And we have Academy Award-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney coming up. But we're going to begin with a book that the Washington Post called inspiring. It's a subject that's on a lot of people's minds today following the shooting in New Zealand and the news that broke in this country yesterday. We learned that the Connecticut Supreme Court had ruled that the gun maker Remington, whose rifle was used in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, can, in fact, be sued over how it marketed the rifle. The news comes almost 1 year after the March for Our Lives, the nationwide demonstration in favor of stronger gun laws, which took place on March 24, 2018. March for Our Lives was largely organized by survivors of the February 14th shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. This new book by Dave Cullen, who is also the author of a widely considered to be the definitive account of the 1999 Columbine shooting, takes a close look at how these survivors have taken the tragic deaths of 17 of their classmates and educators and launched a movement to reform gun laws, the likes of which this country has never seen. Simply titled Parkland, Birth of a Movement, Cullen's book follows several of the Parkland survivors through the past year with special attention paid to their organizing and their demands. And while the book does revisit the atrocity in some detail, it offers a genuine sense of hope for the future. I'm very pleased to welcome Dave Cullen to our stage.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So you essentially embedded with these Parkland kids. The shooting happened on Valentine's Day. When did you head to Parkland?
The Monday after. That was a Wednesday, so I guess 5 days out. I first got a hold of David Hogg on Sunday, and he put me on speaker with the whole group, and I was on a plane the next day.
So when you walked in and you saw these kids, they were being swarmed by media at this point. We all saw it. How did you convince them to let you in?
Well, that's kind of interesting. You know, when I first saw them was the day before they went on their sort of first strike to Tallahassee. So I showed up at a place where there wasn't a lot of media, probably because of what I was trying to do. So when I was on the phone with them, David said a really interesting thing of they had just announced the March for Our Lives in D.C. like an hour or two before on Meet the Press and all the Sunday morning shows. He said, well, it's too late to get a seat on the bus to Tallahassee, but you can follow along behind. And I was like, wait, I thought you were going to D.C. You're doing buses? And he said, oh, well, we're doing this thing first right away. And I was like, wow. And I was like a little worried for them because I thought like, you've already only got 5 weeks, you know, you're spreading yourself too thin, little did I know. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know how they were organizing these things. And I said, oh, okay, so, you know, what are you meeting to do this ahead of time? And Jackie Corin, who's sort of the star of the book and the organizer of this thing, said, oh, I'm organizing that. And I'm like, oh, you got a meeting tomorrow, but that's going to be really boring stuff. You don't want to come to that. And I was like, I think I do. And she said, no, it's like, you know, permission slips and what to wear and bringing your bedroll and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, I definitely want to go. So I don't want to do like the photo op of like, here they are meeting the governor and how did that feel? I want to know what it took behind the scenes to get there. And so partly just because of that, I didn't plan it that way, but hardly any media did come to that meeting because it's sort of like the boring, you know, crap that makes this happen. So that helped so that I was there when there was hardly anybody there and just getting to know them. But mainly, you know, the next day was completely opposite. You know, the buses went and it was a 9-hour trip up the turnpike to get to Tallahassee. And there were hundreds of media outnumbering the kids. And I'm just thinking like, ugh. This, I hate packed journalism. I can't stand this. It's like, you know, what's the point of this? And
the
how am
swarm.
I
going
to get to the kids? Yeah, but I, you know, in my own head, the same conversation is like, okay, I know how this is going to work. The same way with Columbine, I'm going to stay. All these parachute journalists, and I'm not berating them because that's
parachute journalists means people who come in, parachute in, and then leave and go back to New York or DC.
Yeah, but that's their job. If they've got a one-day story or two-day or whatever. But they're going to leave. And I'm going to stay here, and then the kids are going to talk to me. And they did. And I think one other key thing that happened on that first trip that endeared me to Jackie, I saw her at the organizational meeting, and she knew who I was from the phone call. I introduced myself and said she looked really harried. And I said, do you have time for an interview? And she said, I really don't. And that whole trip, she couldn't. I was like 3 feet away from her for much of the next 48 hours and never once asked again for her to do an interview. And she was really grateful that, like, I could have been hounding her, being just like making her life hell. And like, I stayed my distance, followed her, did my job, but didn't pester. And then when a week later, I texted actually her parents, who I had met, and they said, she's in D.C. right now. She'll call you when she finishes this event. And like, it started. That they respect journalists who like do their job, but also give them space. And then I think maybe the biggest thing is I never treated them like children. Except for little kids, I kind of don't completely buy the concept of children. It never occurs to me. I do all kinds of work with high school kids, and I love them, and I've got all these nieces and nephews. And I talk to them the same way I'm talking to you. I never dumbed it down or talked down to them, or like, I did resist the urge to give them guidance, because sometimes, you know, it was 19 years in with survivors. I sometimes wanted to like warn them, and I would bite my tongue a little bit on that, and sometimes be their dad slightly, because I've met all these people who've sort of been there before, but I would bite my tongue. But mainly I treated them like normal people. And finally, I think the web really helps journalism now, because for long form journalists, because instead of if you're writing a book or a piece for Vanity Fair print that's months away, they keep wondering like, okay, who is this guy? Do we trust them? They kept seeing pieces I posted for the web along the way for Vanity Fair and liking, not necessarily agreeing with everything, but feeling I depicted them. They knew which reporters were getting it right, and they often told me. And so, yeah, I think, you know, if they trust you, they'll take you in.
You made some decisions yourself because you did cover Columbine and you have covered these school shootings, and they can be triggering for journalists who have to spend a lot of time. What kind of personal boundaries did you set to protect yourself and so that you could do your job?
Yeah, I'm laughing because like, what boundaries did I set and then break? So I had two bouts of secondary PTSD writing Columbine, which I didn't know it was a thing, but it is. If you're an observer, a witness, EMTs, ambulance, you know, all sorts of careers, professions are afflicted. But I didn't know. And the second one, 7 years out, is the one that really scared me. And I agreed to a lot of conditions with my shrink, one of which was like, never, ever go near one of these while it was still hot. I work with a group out of John Jay College where I studied these. I went on site to Virginia Tech and to Las Vegas. We did the Norway one off-site here in New York City. But I do those. It has to be in either space or time separated. And I'm not allowed to get to know or watch or read anything about survivors or victims. I have to. That's my poison, just empathizing with them. So I'm not allowed to do anything like this. But I decided to go to Parkland to break those rules, just because I decided I'm not going to go there to document tragedy again or horror or the killer. I'm going there because this time immediately seemed like it might be different, and document perhaps the way out. And really, it seemed like maybe from the beginning it was the genesis of some kind of movement or uprising, and I wanted to see that from the outside, from the outset. And so for right away, it was kind of a story of hope to me. And in fact, some Columbine survivors who I know very well now, Connie Sanders, the daughter of Dave Sanders, the one teacher who died heroically saving kids there, about a month out was emailing me and saying, Dave, it's really happening. After all these years, you know, beating our heads against the wall, something's finally happening. It's finally might change.
My guest is Dave Cullen. The name of his book is Parkland, Birth of a Movement. One of the things I want to talk about the activism, but there are so many great details in the book about the kids that we never knew, that like David Hogg is dyslexic and was written off by teachers, and that his sister had a completely different reaction. She was destroyed initially. Tell us a little bit more about some of the personal details you learned about David and Emma.
Sure. Well, you know what? The most interesting thing about David was that first phone call with him, he was kind of the silliest, happiest guy that I've come across in a long time. Really clever jokester. Like, every other line was kind of a joke. And I'm like, okay, this is sort of like delightful, really like whip-smart kid. And so then, over the coming weeks and months, and I think everybody has gotten to know, like, the angry David Hogg, right? On Twitter and on TV. And I was sort of like, huh. Including me, when I interviewed him, I'm like, okay, these are completely opposites. But not necessarily contradictory, just another side of another person. I mean, like, I think we all, you know, everyone in our lives, it's like, our friends and, you know, spouses and so forth aren't one-dimensional people. And so, you know, I think everything that you've seen on TV from these kids and on Twitter is true. They're authentic. That's really them. But it's a piece of them. And sometimes it's a bigger slice than others. And with David, it's the one, it's not even the dominant side of his personality, but it was becoming dominant. So a month out was my first in-depth interview with him in his kitchen. And he got angrier as we talked over the course of an hour, which I was noticing. And, like, I mean, really furious and telling me, I'm an angry person. I'm, you know, nihilistic and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, his mom and dad, well, his dad has Parkinson's and was already home and sort of watching. And then his mom came home. She's a middle school teacher. And so then I was chatting with them. And once I got to know them, I asked them, and I said, you know, David said he's really an angry person. Is he? And his mom, Rebecca, who's a trip, she's just hysterical, she just laughed. And she's like, no, he's angry about this. And he gets angry talking to you guys. But this has made him angry. But that's not his personality. That's this. And I think, by the way, if you guys have seen him, if you've seen him lately on TV, I did Christiane Amanpour's show with him on the anniversary. I have never seen him so calm. I hadn't seen him in person in a couple months. He's really come down to a more okay place, settled in a bit. So that's true of most of them. But in fact, you know, Jackie Corin, who's kind of the star of the book, she's kind of the implementer who really makes everything happen. She's kind of amazing. I talked to her a couple days later, and I also bounces off her. I mean, one of my techniques is whenever one of the kids would tell me anything, I would sort of bounce it off all the other kids, but also, you know, teachers and other activists around them, and sort of, you know, kept bouncing things around and seeing different people's take. And she said, actually, I never met that David until about a week ago. She actually used that phrase. I'm not sure the
exact. That David?
Yeah, that David. I never met him. Huh. Because he didn't. He's also sort of, he's really shy among strangers, which you probably also wouldn't, you know, think of David Hogg, like the least shy person in the world. But he's powerful about this. Picture a debater in high school. Like, yeah. I was a debater. I was painfully shy. But, you know, I would get in a debate and I would go at it. You know, I went to the state meet when I was in high school. But, like, you know, but I was a little meek among other people. But, yeah, until he warmed up to the group, he didn't show that side of himself. Yeah. And it took about 3 weeks.
What was it about their organizing skills that you think broke through and was unusual?
Yeah, I mean, so many things. Partly, I mean, this is a perfect storm of things. But, you know, I think three sort of like big things. Timing, in the culture, meaning there was already something called the resistance. I mean, America was ready to do something and fight back. More than half, two-thirds of America didn't have sort of a cause or a leader. And I mean, that tinder was there ready to be lit. So that was one. Number two was the immediacy. I mean, David Hogg was on TV that night, but really broke through the very next morning within 24 hours on CNN, saying, you know, his famous statement of, we're children, you're adults, and basically saying, you have failed us, and you're letting your kids die, America. So they went right after it. But number three was really the messenger. You know, after Sandy Hook, everyone, including me, thought, well, this is going to be the one that's going to break through.
Little children.
And it has to, little children. What we really miscalculated was, it's not the severity of the horror. It's not the magnitude of how horrible it is. It's the messenger. And we had sort of two messengers. The primary was Barack Obama, and the secondary was parents of kids. And we thought, this amazing, charismatic president, great, and parents of kids, perfect. Can't be a politician. And especially in this divided country that puts half the country against you. And parents, we thought parents of kids are such a powerful force because, you know, we feel so many things: anguish, despair, sadness for them. We don't feel fear. We don't see a parent on TV and picture an AR-15 pointed at their head and somebody blowing their brains out, because they're not in danger. When we see Emma or David or Jackie or Matt Deich or even really any kid in high school who hasn't been attacked talking, we see the targets. And not just the past targets, but the future targets. This is what, you know, we see our own kids and our nieces and nephews and our siblings. And these are the people who are going to die if we don't do something, and we have been dying.
They're
for
the
real.
Lockdown generation. This is all they've known.
Yeah, and we had to hear from the targets, and the targets as the messenger, as horrible as that sound, that's the brutal truth, is the targets as the messenger, complete game changer. And it had never occurred to any of us. And those poor kids at Sandy Hook, I mean, they're still too young to speak for themselves. They're just some of their siblings. But they were too young to speak for themselves. If they had, everything would have changed then. But of course, they couldn't. They were 6, you know, years old.
Yeah. It's a difficult subject. And one of the things that's sort of empowering about your book, and that's some of those words people throw on, but it is because you see these kids taking control. You see them taking back the control. And it was the kids doing it. That's also the interesting thing about the book. It's the kids. The adults are on the periphery the entire time. But you did make an interesting point in the book that part of it is their authenticity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people really believe them and know what's happening with them. But then they started to get into slogans. This is kids for by kids. Mm-hmm. And they realized right away, oh gosh, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. We're becoming the sloganeers. Talking points. The other thing is that they didn't want to be associated with a particular political party, even though the Democrat Party wrapped their arms around them. When they had a misstep, who was there to correct? Did they self-correct? Was it guys like you kind of on the edge, big brothers?
I think it was mostly self-correcting, but there was an interesting thing going on that they kept kind of quiet at the beginning, partly because of this whole right-wing thing that, you know, they're being puppets and who's behind them. In fact, my editor at Vanity Fair, when he sent me down there, was like, keep an eye out, sniffer that. Like, we were sort of like 50-50 on, are the Obama people or the DNC, like, who's helping them out? They're almost too good to be true. Like, it turned out, okay, they're just, I mean, God, you know, the Hillary people, you know, that was one of the things of the Hillary people. Hillary would be in the White House right now if these kids had been, and I'm
kidding. They have a rapid response team to everything that rivals any political operative.
Right, and they're so good. They're so attuned, and because they're not talking points. So they kept kind of quiet because they were very, but there were about half a dozen kids who are recent graduates, either the year or 2 years before, who were on the team. Matt Deitch now is very prominent. He went on The Daily Show with Emma. That really helped. So they had a little bit of distance. They hadn't been in the school. They were a little older and wiser. The kids all knew them. You know, they'd been friends. And they were outside the spotlight. So, you know, like when you're in the spotlight, it can be very, very different, difficult to see behind that. And that's why you're asking, like, who advised them? Like, so you had, and in fact, one of the kids was at college at North Carolina and studying mass media, was very useful at helping them. He had also was physically some distance. He came down for a short time to help them, but then was sort of like, you know, here's my view from outside the bubble. Somebody they know and trust. And so they sort of had their own, you know, slightly separated team helping them and keeping them in line and each other in check. It helped if there were like about, you know, 25 of them. So like when one person was sort of like going off a little bit, you know, their friends could be like, I might want to rein that in. You know, they had each other.
So today, where is the movement? Where are these kids? Are they still working as a unit because people went off to college? People have lives. There's very sweet moments in the books where they're thinking about their prom and about the school play. Where are they today?
Well, they hit sort of a reckoning point about the 6-month mark leading up to the midterms, where that 2-month bus tour across America was kind of amazing last summer, but rough. And, you know, some people who've been in bands are like, welcome to, you know, every band in America. That was sort of the shakeout of some people. It was also time to go back to school and college. And some of the kids who had said, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, realized like, oh my God, okay, I can't do this for the rest of my life. So a handful of them moved on. Most of them are still doing it, but they're now transitioning from being a a completely volunteer and just full-time. They essentially took a year off of school. I made that an extracurricular. A sprint to the midterms to now making it an ongoing group with some full-time staff. And their big push this semester is college campuses, where they didn't spend as much time, where every college campus in America is Young Republicans, Democrat group, global warming, you know, LGBT, et cetera. So there's already something in place, and there's funding sources for all these groups. And so if they get a March for Our Lives chapter on every major campus in America, that's a self-sustaining thing, which has, so they're working on a chapter across America, which they already have, but really college campuses. And Jackie and David are both going to Harvard in the fall, where they still plan to work on this, but you can't go to Harvard and, you know, have that as, you know, your part-time job. They got to be serious about that. So they want a lot in place so they can continue this, but not as a full-time pursuit or 60, you know, 80 hours a week.
The name of the book is Parkland. Dave Cullen, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, the creators of the Broadway musical Come From Away. And now to all of its collaboration with the Academy of American Poets and its Poem A Day project. It's the only daily digital poetry series. The Academy invited 12 guest editors to each curate a month of poems in 2019. If you sign up at poets.org, a poem will appear in your inbox every day. And without further ado, here is today's poem.
Hi, I'm Jen Givon, and this is my poem of color, of landscape, of tenuous rope. I've pulled from my throat birdsong like tin-sheeted lullaby. It's vicious cold. It's hoax of wings. The rest of us forest folk. Dark angels chafing rabbit's foot for luck. Thrum-necked. Wear the face of nothing. We've changed. The zodiac and I have refused a little planet, little sum for struggle, and sailed ourselves summer-long and arbitrary as a moon grave across a vastness. We've left the children. Name the place penniless motherhood. Name the place country of mothers. Name the place anywhere but death by self. Infliction is a god of many faces, many nothings. I'm afraid I'll never be whole. I'm afraid the rope from the hardware store, screws for nails, will teach itself to knot. I've looked up noose, I've learned to twine, but these babies now, halfway pruned through the clean bathwater of childhood, I promised a god I would take to the ledge and show the pinstripes. The pinkening strobe lights may be angels chiseled at creation into the rock around my neck. The rock in the river, I would never let them see. I would never let them break and spend a whole life backing away from that slip. Let us fly and believe in the wreck. Their perfect, hope-sealed bodies, the only parachutes we need.
If you'd like to have a poem a day in your life, sign up at poets.org.